Gayet evlilik.
Gayet.
Vakti de evlilik.
Gayet.
Dersimin ayetliği.
Gayet.
Samvet vakti vendiki.
Gayet.
Or penemendi.
Free.
All glories to the assembled
people.
All glories to the assembled people. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Shankaraya. Krishna Prasad Recreation. Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pratani Namaste Sasani Mani Pasakadis. Chana Kandam. Shri Guru Shri Jabhari Kamalam. Shri Guru Vaishnavascha. Shri Guru Prasad Gujaitam. Saravana Arvindakam. Vikas Tamasajivam. Saravaitam. Saravaitam. Padichamaya Sahitam. Prishachayitam. Dinam. Shri Radha Krishna Parasadina Lalita Shri Shakamba Kansha Anchakapa Jivishakti Sindhya Vitakti Chakamba Nidhya Vashri Yama Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Australia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 17, Description of the Varnashrama System, Text 31. Yajnasho chandasam lokam.
Yajnasho chandasam lokam.
Aroksham brahma vistapam.
Aroksham brahma vistapam.
Gurave vinyasadeham.
Gurave vinyasadeham.
Swadhyartham brihadvrata.
Swadhyartham brihadvrata.
Question.
Yajasa chandra samlokam.
Yajasa chandra samlokam.
Aroksham brahma vistapam.
Aroksham brahma vistapam.
Guraye vinyasaddeham.
Guraye vinyasaddeham.
Swadhyartham brihadvrata.
Swadhyartham brihadvrata.
Yajasau chandasam lokam.
Yajasau chandasam lokam.
Aroksyan brahma vistapam.
Aroksyan brahma vistapam.
Gurave vinyasat deham.
Gurave vinyasat deham.
Swadhyayartham brihat vrataha.
Swadhyayartham brihat vrataha.
Ladies.
Yadi asau
chandasam lokam.
Aroksham
brahma vistapam.
Gurave vinyasat deham.
Gurave vinyasat deham.
Swadhyartham brihat vrataha.
Swadhyartham brihat vrataha.
Yajasau chandasam lokam.
Aroksham brahma vistapam.
Gurave
vinyasiddeham.
Swadhyayartham
brihat vrataha.
Yadi.
Yadi.
If.
Asau.
So, that student.
Chandasam.
Chandasam lokam.
Chandasam lokam.
The Mahaloka planet.
The Mahaloka planet.
Arokshan.
Arokshan.
Desiring to ascend to.
Desiring to ascend to.
Brahma vistapam.
Brahma vistapam.
Brahma loka.
Brahma loka.
Gurave.
Gurave.
Unto the guru.
Unto the guru.
Vinyaset.
Vinyaset.
He should offer.
He should offer.
Deham.
Deham.
His body.
His body.
Swa-adhyaya.
Swa-adhyaya.
Of superior Vedic studies.
Of superior Vedic studies.
Artham.
Artham.
For the purpose.
For the purpose.
Brihadvrataha.
Brihadvrataha.
Observing the powerful vow of perpetual celibacy.
Observing the powerful vow of perpetual celibacy.
So the word brihad literally means what?
Big.
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 So it's a idiom. Brihadvrata, the big vow. So it's an idiom that generally refers to life in a Siddhi Brahmacharya. Purport. One who desires the translation. If the brahmachari student desires to ascend to the Maharloka or Brahmaloka planets, then he should completely surrender his activities to the spiritual master and, observing the powerful vow of perpetual celibacy, dedicate himself to superior Vedic studies. Purport. One who desires the supreme perfection of life must engage his body, mind, and words in the service of a bona fide spiritual master. One desiring elevation to superior planets such as Brahmaloka and Maharloka must fully engage in the spiritual master's service. We can thus imagine the sincerity of purpose and service required to achieve the Krishna Loka planet, which lies far beyond the material universe. Yadgyaso chandasam lokam aroksham brahma vistapam gurave vinyasad deham swajadyartam brahmavrata. The brahmachari student desires to attend to the Maharloka or Brahmaloka planets, then he should completely surrender his activities to the spiritual master and, observing the powerful vow of perpetual celibacy, dedicate himself to superior Vedic studies. So here we have a destination, Chandasam Lokam, the higher planets, Mahaloka, Gyaniloka, Tapaloka, Ramaloka, and the three requirements with the Deha, his Deha, Vinyasa Deha, he offers his body to the Guru, he studies the Vedas, Swadhyayam, and Brihadvrata, one takes the great vow of Brahmacharya. So, before there was the verse for the brahmachari who married, and here is the verse for the brahmachari who doesn't marry. So here it's you get what you pay for, right? You want something, you pay for it. As we say, there's no free lunch, or if it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. We're all looking for a bargain or something free. Oh, it's free, good. You can get people to do things they wouldn't normally do just by telling them that it's free. But here we see the world is not really set up like that. There isn't anything that's free. For everything, there's a price. And this is pulls into the mentality of people in the modes. So in what mode of nature does everyone want something for free? Ignorance. In the mode of ignorance, you want something for free. You want to steal it. So Vrajalakshmi Devadasi was telling me how that when they were in Papua New Guinea, some thief broke into the house and stole their things and then shook their hands and said, "I'm so sorry, I'm stealing your things." As if that's somehow going to reduce the karma, you know. "I'm going to steal your money. I'm sorry I'm taking your money, but I just have to." So this is the mood in Tamagun. The mood in Tamagun is that I should get everything for free. I shouldn't do any kind of yajna. And whatever I want, I should just get no matter what. Right? And in Tamagun, basically the mood is I want it right now, and never mind the consequences. Let's hope I don't have to pay for it at all, and if I have to pay for it, let it be in the future. You know, I'll worry about that later. There may be harm to me, there may be harm to others, but, you know, never mind. So that is the mood of Tamagun. The mood of Tamagun is I don't want to do any yajna. And this is, of course, pervading modern society. Completely pervading modern society. Let me find a way to make money that's not honest. Right? Gambling is in that mood. Let me make money where there's no exchange of goods and services. Or the fact that people today are no longer marrying at all. Right? So this is a very tamagun thing. Let me get sex without payment, without yajna, without any kind of commitment. So this is all in the realm of tamagun. Let me get some intoxication also. Is let me try to get some pleasure without earning the pleasure. Let me just get it artificially by chemically stimulating my brain and body. You know, normally if you want to get happiness, you have to earn the happiness. So I don't want to earn it, I just want to drink something. I just want to smoke something. So this is all very much tamagun. Let me get the produce from the earth without proper cultivation of the earth. Let me just pour a bunch of chemicals into the earth instead of taking care of the earth. And force. Hemanda Kashyapu was also doing this, was also forcing the earth to give more than required. And, you know, let me just eat the animals. Let me not cultivate food, let me just eat the animals. And let me pour chemicals into the animals so that they grow fat, you know, in 1 month, and then I can kill them. And this is all very, very tamagun. Let me get as much as I can get without sacrifices. Let me get the free lunch. Let me get, or as cheaply as possible, and whatever the consequences are. I don't think there are any consequences. I think there's no God in control. I think there's no universal law. I'm just a product of evolution, and I can just do whatever I want. But then human life begins. This is a chapter about Varnashram. Human life begins with the concept of yajna. This is a whole concept that you have to pay for things. And civilized human beings teach their children from a young age that if you want something, you have to earn it. You know, if you want a good education, you have to actually do the work. You don't just copy your neighbor's work. Right? If you want to enjoy the opposite sex, you have to get married. Actually, if you want to even earn money, according to Varnashram, you have to get married. And Bhakti Rautipur said, I wanted to earn money, so keeping in mind the codes of religion, I took a wife. So the brahmachari, the vanaprastha, the sannyasi, they don't have a job. So if you want to have a job, even you want to have an income, then at least you have to take the sacrifice of taking care of your spouse, taking care of children, giving charity to the society. Right? And if you want to enjoy sex, not only do you have to take the responsibility for a spouse, you have to take the responsibility of producing good population for the planet. You have to give back. You have to give back for things. Right? If you want to enjoy the freedom of the renounced orders, then you have to live very simply. You know, everything has its price. So if you want to go to the higher planets, I've been in correspondence with this one devotee who keeps saying he doesn't like being on Earth. Which I totally can understand why somebody would not want to be on Earth, especially in the Kali Yuga. And he says, can't I just do my bhakti on one of the higher planets? Why do I have to finish on the Earth planet? Can I just go right now to the higher planets and finish my bhakti there? But going to the higher planets is not so easy. Right? It's just like if you say, well, I don't like the economy seat. I want to have a first class seat. Well, everybody would like to have a first class seat, but it's more expensive, right? Maybe the economy seat is $300 and the first class seat is $4,000. You know, so if you want to live on these higher planets, then you have to study the Vedas, fully dedicate your body to the Guru, and observe celibacy. So this is the... Why? Because that's what they're doing there. Now that's what they're doing on these higher planets. This is described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, that there's Indra's planet. They're like the Kshatriyas of the universe, and they're enjoying great sense gratification and piety. Then above that are the planets of the Prajapatis. They're engaged in yajna, producing a good population for the planets. And above them, there's the planets of the renunciates. So in Indra's heaven and in the Prajapatis' planets, they're mostly Grihasthas. And then above that, they're all brahmacharis. They're all celibates, like the four Kumaras, right, and the nine Yogendras. And they're just engaged in meditation. So if you want to go to one of those planets, then that has to be your mood. Otherwise, you're not even going to fit in. So you're practicing now, and you're brahmachari now, and just dedicating now, and then you can go to those planets. So in the mode of passion, one takes up these activities. Okay, I want this, I will pay for it. I want this, I will pay for it. But it's still a very fruitive mentality. The fruitive mentality of the mode of ignorance isn't gone. It's just that one is thinking, now I have to get it legitimately. And most religion only goes up to that point. Most religion in the world only teaches up to Rajaguna, or maybe a little suffering. That if you want something, you pay for it, you don't just steal it, and you follow the laws of God, and if you want something higher, then you pay for it in a higher way. You know, but it's all about payment, it's all very fruitive. It's all about, what do I want? And okay, to get that, there's a God, and therefore I have to pay God for what I want. So then above that is Satvagun, and in Satvagun, one is not simply interested in enjoying the world, one is interested more in moksha. Of course, in the lower realms of Satvagun, one is still interested in enjoying the world. But one no longer wants to enjoy the world by having this or that thing, one wants to enjoy the world by being balanced and equal poised within. And in that mood, one performs either Varnashram as Karma Yoga, or one studies the Vedas here, which is described as Jnana Yoga, or one meditates as Jnana Yoga, or one may even do a kind of Karma Nidra Bhakti, or Jnana Nidra Bhakti, or Yoga Nidra Bhakti, for the purpose of salvation, for the purpose, or for a little lower purpose of peace, and freedom, and equanimity, and inner happiness. And on that platform also, one is understanding that in order to get what I desire, I have to do some sacrifice. I have to give something. But the mood's a little different. Instead of I'm giving something just so I can go to a higher planet, where it's going to be so much more comfortable, it's I'm giving something so I can feel happy within. So like in the mode of ignorance, if somebody hurts you, you just get revenge. In the mode of passion, you think, well, let me be forgiving so people will praise me and so I'll get good karma. and the Lord of goodness, you think, let me be forgiving so I'll feel happy and satisfied with him, whatever I get from good karma. And but all of these require sacrifice. The person in the world of ignorance is sacrificing later. They sacrifice later and they have a greater sacrifice. Right? I mean, if you go to the store and you pay $20 for something, that's a sacrifice. If you get paid $20 an hour, you sacrifice an hour for those things that you pay the 20. You exchanged an hour of your energy for those things. If you steal the things and you get put in jail, then you have to go to court, you have to talk with the lawyer, that all that may take you 30, 40 hours, right? And then if you stay in jail for 3 days, so you sacrifice a lot more than an hour. Does that make sense? So in the mode of ignorance, you have a much bigger sacrifice, and it comes later. In the mode of passion, you have an equal sacrifice that comes first. And in the mode of goodness, and in one sense, you have the smallest amount of sacrifice, because what you're sacrificing is more your lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion, in order to feel balanced within. And interestingly enough, I mean, here, Vidyananda Maharaj is talking about the first part of the purport is basically from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport, but the last sentence is Vidyananda Maharaj's own purport. He says, we can thus imagine the sincerity of purpose and service required to achieve the Krishna Loka Plan, which lies far beyond the material universe. So you could say, all right, that there's this much sacrifice to go to Tapaloka Mahara. It must be a bigger sacrifice to go to Krishna Loka. But it only appears like that from the material perspective, because actually the higher you go, the smaller the sacrifice becomes. Just like if you want inner happiness in Satyagun, do you have to, you know, work hard at a job? Like you have to, if you want the happiness of Rajagun, you have to put in a lot of hours and a lot of effort and a lot of energy. Do you have to do that for the happiness of Satyagun? No, you just have to let go of things like anger and lust and greed. Do you follow? That's all you have to do. You don't have to have any particular big qualifications. You don't have to have. So in bhakti, really, all you have to do to get bhakti is what? What do you have to do to go to Krishna Loka and get bhakti?
Do bhakti.
You have to do bhakti. Just like if you want to go to the planets of the brahmacharis, you have to be a brahmacharis. If you want to go to the bhakti planets, you have to do bhakti. But what is involved with bhakti?
Surrender.
Just surrender. It's actually not a big deal. It can be done in a moment, and it can be done as easily as taking a little charanamrita. It can be done as easily as saying one name of Krishna. It doesn't require some big vow, brihadvrata. Of course, Krishna says brihadvrata. They're very determined in this bhakti. But externally, it doesn't require all of those things. It's not required. It requires a change of consciousness, and that change process is a very small change of consciousness, actually. From I'm the enjoyer to Krishna's the enjoyer. From it's all about me to it's all about Krishna. That's all it requires. It doesn't even require all of the endeavor of somebody in Satvagun. Okay, instead of being angry, I'm going to be forgiving. I'm just hearing that in the seventh canto this morning. You conquer this by this, right? You conquer this by this, you conquer this by this. It doesn't even require that, which is for Satvagun. It just requires that jivarita swarupayana that Jira Krishna does. I am Krishna's servant. And it can be a moment's business. Now, of course, that, in one sense, it's very easy, it's very simple. Why doesn't it require some big sacrifice? Because it's already who we are. It's already who we are. Like the nice verse in the 10th canto about, as with Daibak, that one who goes on tolerating the resultant actions of their past misdeeds always prevails. That he inherits the kingdom of God. And it's explained that just like a child inherits the parents' property just by staying alive, you don't have to do something extraordinary to inherit your parents' property. You have to do something extraordinary to be disinherited. But you don't have to do anything extraordinary to inherit if you have normal parents. You only have to be alive. So to awaken our original position, it's already there. It's not something to be gained from another source. It's not something to be achieved through austerity. It's not something really to be paid for. It's not a fruitive activity. It's already there. It's already in the heart of the living entity. And Prabhupada, in talking about sadhana bhakti, sadhana is a practice, he said there really isn't a particular practice that can awaken it. It's already there. However, for most of us, because of our attachments, it appears like it's this whole process with all this sacrifice and all this vows and all this giving up and all this struggle. And unfortunately, we make it like that due to our attachments. And that's the real story. I mean, you can think of it just like if a person has never taken alcohol, you know, they don't have to. Going without alcohol is very easy. It's not a struggle. It's not a tapasya. Yes? If you've never been an alcoholic, you never think throughout the day, oh, what am I going to do without alcohol? It's not a struggle. But once you become an alcoholic, then it's a struggle. Then you have to go to a treatment program, and you have physical withdrawal symptoms, and you may have to go through procedures and medicines that are painful. So does that mean the process of being sober is painful and difficult? Is that what that means? No. It means that if you choose to become an alcoholic, you then make the process of becoming sober painful again. And is it the fault of the doctor that it's painful and difficult? The doctor may be administering, here's some treatment, here's some medicine, and it will make you suffer. Is the doctor making you suffer? Really? No. The suffering is coming from our own choice. So therefore we say kevala ananda kanda. We say bhakti is a very easy thing. I mean, the price is really nothing. The only price is giving up our pain. That's the only price. Please give up your suffering. Oh, big price. I don't know if I can do it. It'll take me a few lifetimes. But I'm done suffering. So we perceive it like that. And depending on what mode we're in, you know, we may, if we're really in the mode of ignorance, we may think, okay, let me see if I can get bhakti really cheap. I'll just find some sadhu, put their dust on my head. You know, I'll try to find some cheap way of getting it, or for the mode of passion, we think, okay, I'm going to get this bhakti, I might chant 120 hours a day, and I'll offer 10 artiks, and I'm going to do park around all the holy places, and do this and that and this. I'm going to do all this yajna and all these vows, and then I will have earned my bhakti. You know, we're very much in Satyagun. We're going to think, okay, you know, by studying the Vedas, by detachment, by equanimity, by developing good qualities, then I'll become equipoised and happy within, and in that way I'll be all bhakti. So we may calculate like that depending on the modes that we're in. But really, bhakti isn't within the modes of each of you. It's simply a desire to love Krishna. That's all it is. It's a desire to love and serve Krishna. I really like your heart saying, you want to offer his body to the Guru. I'm putting together a seminar right now in Abhinivedanam, and surrendering one's body, mind, and words to the Guru, surrendering one's body, mind, and words to Krishna. And the comparison given by Rupa Goswami is just like if you sell an animal to somebody else, you don't worry about its maintenance anymore. You know, you sell your dog, someone takes your dog, then it's not your responsibility anymore. And so once we've sold ourselves to Krishna, our maintenance isn't our responsibility anymore. It's Krishna's maintenance. That doesn't mean you don't work at your job if you're a grihastha, that's your duty. But you're doing your duty and Krishna's maintaining it. So the price for bhakti, the real tapasya for bhakti, the real tapasya to go to Goloka, how do you buy your ticket for Goloka? Again, you don't buy it. You already have it. You don't have to purchase the ticket. But sometimes we use this kind of, you know, like Rupa Goswami says, if you can find this reed, you just beg, borrow, or steal, purchase it without delay. Or we talk about the guru planting the seed of bhakti. We give these kind of analogies for our material understanding. We already have the ticket. It's already there. Mahaprabhu gives this analogy of the astrologer who tells the poor man, your father left a treasure for you.
You just have to find it. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this morning. Love for Krishna is already there in the heart of a living entity. It's not received from any other source. It's just a question of finding it, just a question of looking for it and of wanting it. And all of the processes that we do, all of the vows that we take, you know, the whole process of bhakti, it's not a way of bribing Krishna, like in Tamagun. It's not a way of earning it, like in Rajagun. We're not earning our way back to Godhead. We're not achieving it. Nor is it even a way of just, you know, okay, I'm going to conquer passion and ignorance and just be free. It's none of those things. It's engaging in the activities of Goloka. Now, and as we engage in the activities of Goloka now, then we generally, gradually remember, oh, that's who I am. Something like a person with amnesia, that they introduce them to their family members, they take them to their home, and they show them the food they like to eat and so forth. And gradually, oh, I remember this, I remember this, I remember this. So that's really what it is. Although we may put it in the language of fruitive activity so it makes some sense to us, so we can relate to it. And of course there is some sacrifice involved, has to be. But it's the kind of sacrifice that's involved when you love somebody that doesn't feel like a sacrifice. When you're planning a birthday party for your best friend, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice, right? It feels like a pleasure. I mean, that's even true in the mode of goodness. In the mode of goodness, when you're doing your sacrifice to become happy, the sacrifice and the happiness all merge together. But in Bhagavad Gita 4.24, Krishna explains that when the person who's offering, what they're offering, the recipient of the offering, when they're all in Krishna consciousness, everything becomes merged into transcendence. So if one is really in bhakti yoga, one shouldn't be feeling that one is doing some sort of sacrifice. You shouldn't feel like that. If we feel like that, we're not really in bhakti. I mean, just like we experience when I'm cooking for Krishna and when I'm eating the prasada, can be equally pleasurable. In fact, sometimes cooking can be more pleasurable than eating. Yes, we all have this experience. Working behind the scenes for a festival and going and enjoying the festival can be equally pleasing. And it doesn't, if we're doing it out of love, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice. So this is the real way to get to Goloka. This is the real ticket to get to Goloka. Also, I was just hearing Prabhupada say this morning, everything we do is meant, it's funny because I've been talking about this the last 3 days, and then Prabhupada was talking about this morning, that everything we're doing is meant to increase our attachment to Krishna. That's the sacrifice, that's the vow. To love the Guru, to love Krishna, to love the devotees. I'm going to talk about that. To just give up this idea that I am the center and I'm very important, and everything is about me and everything is about my satisfaction. And even on a material level, that's what kills relationships. Just like if you see marriage is falling apart, you know, they're really struggling. Pretty much always, 99% of the time. It's because one or both parties are thinking, what about me? You know, what about me? I've given this much and you've only given this much, you know. And they're calculating like that. And it kills love completely. You know, completely. What about me? What about me? I'm the center. Everyone's meant to serve me. Everyone's meant to serve me. So that's the sacrifice. Is we're all meant to serve Krishna. Everyone isn't meant to serve me. That's the mentality of love. And then, frankly, we're already in Goloka even in this life. It's not just, okay, I've got to tolerate this life and then I die and then I take an airplane. But because this is also Krishna's energy, we've been talking about that also yesterday a lot, because this is also Krishna's energy, when I have that mentality, then one experiences that one is in the spiritual world, even in this life. It begins with transcendental television, that Krishna's leelas start manifesting in the heart. And it gets to the point that one sees that Krishna is everywhere, just like Mahaprabhu. He saw the ocean, he thought it was the Jamuna. He saw the hill, he thought it was Govardhan. He's seeing the spiritual world everywhere. So one in that, one, as soon as we give up this idea that I'm the center, then we see, oh, there's Vrindavan. There's Mahaprabhu's Leela, there's Govardhan, there's the Jhumara. So questions or comments or corrections or additions or subtractions, chastisements. Yes, Phil.
In Nectar of Instruction, Srila Rupa Goswami describes that in the conditioned state of life, we cannot taste Krishna. Although Krishna is sweet, we have like jaundice. So my understanding is that it is actually a big sacrifice for us to put ourselves out of the comfort zone and try to practice Krishna consciousness, although sometimes we don't have any taste. And also Mahaprabhu says that I'm so unfortunate that I don't have any attraction for chanting.
Mm. So you're saying that for one who doesn't have any taste for Krishna, that it's a big sacrifice to serve Krishna even though one has no taste.
I'm saying it is sacrifice.
Yes, and Prabhupada talks about until nistha, it's a hard struggle with determination. But how long does that take? How long is one required to have a hard struggle with determination? Is there a certain set time? Is it like you go to a college and they say, you know, you have to take this course and this course and this course, and then there's, you can't simply jump, you have to go through, and it's going to take a certain amount of time? Or is it like if you're, you know, walking from here to there, you know, you can increase your walking speed to a point, but there's a limit on the human body how fast you can walk from here to there. So is it like that with walking? Does it have to take, you know, a certain number of lifetimes or a certain number of years in order to get through the hard struggle with determination and get to nistha and start having nishi and start having taste? Is it? What determines how long that takes? Who's in charge of that? No. Yeah. How long could it take? It could take a moment. So is it the nature of the process and the nature of bhakti that makes a big part of it in the beginning a sacrifice? I'm sorry. It's a very hard thing to face. And frankly, most of us don't want to face it. It's not the nature of the process. It's not Krishna's will. It's not some sort of law. Yes, it's generally what happens. Generally, for most conditioned souls, they go through some period where it's a hard struggle with determination. So because generally that's what happens, therefore the acharyas describe that there's this process. But they also describe that it's entirely possible to skip all of those steps. You don't have to go through those steps. And there are examples in the Shastra of people who did skip all those steps. And it wasn't just, well, there was some, like, you know, magic fairy dust that fell on them and they were just lucky and maybe that happened to win the lottery or something like that. Most of us very actively and very strongly resist the process of bhakti even as we are engaging it. Most of us are very non-compliant patients. Because the real process of bhakti, again, is not just, okay, I'm chanting my 16 rounds every day, I'm chanting my 3 dharikas, I worship the deity. The real process is I'm putting Krishna at the center. And all of those things are for that purpose. And that we resist that like crazy. I mean, we just like fight it. Okay, Hare Krishna in the center, Hare Krishna in the center. Yes?
I have this understanding that we see example of pure love for Krishna in our acharyas, in the devotees, mm-hmm. in Bhagavatam. But before we get to that point, somebody has to put a mirror to us and show us who we really are in the conditioned state.
Absolutely, that is absolutely true.
And an Anartha Nibriti process, we need to actually first face where we are and then see.
Absolutely, but that can happen in an instant. That doesn't have to take a very long time. I regularly experience that people have been in this process for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and they haven't even started an Arjanavritti. And other people, after a year, they're flying through an Arjanavritti. So it really, it's not a set thing. Chetodarpa and Arjanam, the mirror that shows you who you really are and you're an artist, can happen on one chanting of one name of Krishna. And if one accepts that immediately, then it would be, you know, it would all be over. All right, so we'll accept I'm not willing to do that. That's okay. It's okay to be honest and say, I'm not willing to do that. But then we should understand that our hard struggle with determination and all our sacrifice and all of it is because we're not willing to do it. That's okay. That's all right. Slowly is better than not at all. Yeah. At least one should be making progress. But we should understand, at least theoretically, that it's me. It's my resistance. It's my holding back. It's my only being willing to see the truth in very small increments with very big gaps between them. I mean, I'm sure there's many conditioned souls that take 100 lifetimes to learn one karmic lesson. Right, we have these, you know, karmic reactions where you take birth as many times as there's hairs on the body of a cow and get killed over and over and over and over. That's a lot of lifetimes to learn that you should have empathy for animals. That's a long, long, long time to learn one thing. Is it necessary? Do you need to take, you know, 10,000 births as a cow that gets slaughtered to learn that you should be nice to animals? Is that required? You can learn that in 5 minutes, right? Does that make sense? So, all right. If I'm a fool, I'm a fool. Okay. Then to me, it's going to seem like some long, drawn-out sacrifice going on and on and on and on and on with only little tiny specks of bursts of some taste periodically.
Understand that bhakti is actually mercy and we cannot earn it by any.
How do we understand that bhakti is mercy? The mercy is already there. Yes, bhakti is mercy. You can't earn it because it's already there. And it's there because it's Krishna's gift. We never did earn it, we never could earn it, we already just have it. It's like an inheritance. You don't earn an inheritance. It's just there. It's just, you don't earn the food your parents give you when you're, you know, when you're in your parents' home and you're a child. You're not earning that food at 3 or 4 years old. It's just their mercy. But of course it's there. I mean, unless you have really abusive parents. They're going to feed you. Yes? Not only are they going to feed you, but they're going to bring all kinds of things for you to do. Do you give her just the bare necessities of life? Of course not. And excuse, I don't mean any offense, but you're just an ordinary jiva, yes? We're just ordinary jivas with so many faults. Right? Are you a perfect mother? No. But still, look what you give. You don't give your daughter just, you know, just barely enough food to live. One set of clothes. So yes, the child's dependent on the mercy of the parents, but the mercy is there, of course it's there. Krishna's mercy is there for every living entity, all the time. What to speak of us in this room? Can any of us in this room say we still need to get some sort of mercy we haven't gotten yet? Is this some fault on Prabhupada's fault, or your Maharaj's fault, or Krishna's fault, something he hasn't given you? Are you waiting for that? This is a package delivery from their side that hasn't come yet. It's already there. So yes, it's all mercy. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said the man in the well, you know, someone has to throw the rope, but then you have to grab the rope. It's already there. But for every living entity, Krishna is in the heart, Ishvara Sarvabhutana. Krishna is Suvidam Sarvabhutana. He's the well-wisher of any living entity. As soon as the living entity has a desire, Krishna immediately reciprocates with that. And it's not that Krishna's whimsical, well, you know, these guys aren't going to give them mercy. Is that all right? Even if you want to say somebody out there doesn't have mercy, okay, but we have mercy. Even if you want to make an argument for somebody out there, you can't make that argument for any of us. It's not that this Prabhu has more mercy than you have. You have more mercy than I have, or something like that. That's just, it doesn't work right. Especially going inside. They're just flooding with mercy. They're not even considering, right, who's fit and who's unfit. They're just offering it to everybody equally. Anybody else? Yes.
You were mentioning about, is it the problem, the lack of faith we have in the process? That's why we are
You could call it that. There's many different names you could put on it, and that is one of them. That we don't have faith. We have fear. It's the opposite of faith. If I let go of my false ego, if I let go of being in the center, I won't be taken care of anymore. I won't get what I need. Okay, I'm not getting much of what I need right now, but at least I'm getting something. And if I just left it up to Krishna, then maybe I wouldn't. Maybe if I fully gave myself to the process, it wouldn't work, so I have to have all these other things going on. So, yeah. So therefore, for most people, it is gradual. You do a little surrender, and you see that it works, and then you do a little more surrender, and you see that it works, and do a little more surrender. And, you know, you get the mirror held up, and you go, oh, okay. We'll let go of that. And then it's wonderful. And so then they show you something else. Krishna and Guru shows you something else. You let go of that. And they show you something else. I think of it like a big tree. And they show you, you know, here you have this branch of this tree, and it's all rotten and all full of maggots. Okay, let it go. And they show you another tree, another branch, and you let it go. Pretty soon the tree's really weak, because they cut off so many branches. And then finally they show you the root, and then finally you're willing to let it go. Krishna usually tries to show us the root very early on, and generally we're not willing to see it. So he says, all right, let's just look at some of the branches. I'm sure you sometimes counsel somebody like that. You can see the root of their problem, and you say, here's the root, and they resist you. So then you work on something smaller. You say, okay, let's just work on this thing. But many people resist on even working on the little things, sometimes for decades. Isn't it? Yes? Yes? Yeah, it's like a fit. It's my tree and it's my shelter. What will I do without my tree? It's where I live. But it's all rotten and it's all full of maggots and it's actually strangling you. So therefore, for most of us, it's gradual, and for most of us, it appears to have a lot of austerity, a lot of difficulty. That's the lived reality for most of us. But that doesn't mean that it's something you pay for, like in Rajagun. Just because we experience it something like that due to our attachment doesn't mean the process is, okay, I want Krishna Bhakti, therefore I make this for a payment. And I earn it. Is that clear? Anything else? Yes.
Was this thinking of the pastime of Ajmila? Bharat Maharaj, and I was trying to compare and was thinking, like, does Krishna practice favoritism at times? Like, you know, how Ajmila, Ajmila,
So what were you comparing specifically with Ajmila and Bharat?
Like, Bharat Maharaj, although he was at a very grand stage, but still he had to take the form of
a deer.
And
Ajamil, although he was very fallen, he got to go back to Godhead.
By just yelling out the name of this, and he didn't even meant to remember Krishna directly.
So that it seems a little whimsical.
Like as if Krishna is still giving some favoritism for him.
I tell you, that's one of the general ways in which we think. Just generally, the way that conditioned souls think is my problems are God's fault. That's generally how we think. And of course that's the whole root of the whole tree. That's the whole root of our whole problem, is that God's not a good enough God and I would be a much better God. If I were running the show, I would run it quite differently, especially for me. And any religionist, they go to God and say, okay, I'd like my life run like this and like this and like this. I mean, you've been running it that way, and that's cool, you know, but look, it really should be run this way. You do that, please, okay? And I'll offer you some incense and some money and whatever you want. I'll bribe you, whatever you want, you know, I'll even tell you what I love you, whatever's necessary, so you'll run my life my way, because I know better. So we have this basic thing that there's something wrong with God. That he's whimsical, that he's selfish, that he's not all powerful, or there's some problem with him. And I could do a much better job, which is rather humorous. Since I can't even control, you know, the color of my hair. Whatever. So let's look at these things. So that Bharat Maharaj, he was in a very high level of, he was already experiencing bhava. And generally, a person doesn't fall from bhava. But Bharat Maharaj had been the king, he'd been the emperor. And he still had some of this Ishwara Bhav. His Ishwara Bhav is not a mood of, I want to control you, although it has the word Ishwara. But it's really more like a parent. You know, the king was like a big, big parent. And it's more a mood of, I want to take care, I'm going to shelter. And so this was, when he saw this orphaned deer, prematurely born orphaned deer, it brought this out again in him. That he was supposed to have given that up. That wasn't his service anymore. There was a time when he was the king, and his service to Krishna was to protect all of the human and non-human citizens on Krishna's behalf. That was his duty. But now he was in a different ashram. He moved from the Grahastha ashram to the Vanaprastha ashram. And he didn't have that service anymore. He had a different service. So now when he was doing it, it was out of personal attachment. It wasn't out of service anymore. It was, I am the protector. I am the protector. I mean, there wouldn't have been any harm if he had just given the deer some prasada and had given the deer some place to stay until it was old enough to go into the forest. And we have Shivananda saying he took care of a dog, for example. So, yeah, there wouldn't have been any harm in that. In the seventh canto, it says the house owner should feed all, even the snakes and the flies, as if they're their own children, so like the speaker, there's some, you know, orphaned animal. But the problem was he got into this mood that I am the protector and I am the carer. And he got attached to this deer as the source of meeting his emotional needs. He switched his emotional attachment from Krishna over to the deer. And this is simply a misuse of his free will. And Srila Prabhupada explains at the very, 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 very end of that story, one of the very, very last purports, after Jud Bharat and Maharaj Rahugana part ways, it's one of the very last purports, after the instruction of King Rahugana, that the reason Bharat Maharaj had this problem was that he didn't take shelter in his guru. He was in Puaha Ashram, so we were assuming he was a disciple of Puaha Muni. And he didn't go to Puaha Muni and say, what do I do with this orphan deer? How do I deal with this orphan deer? And when he started noticing that the deer was causing problems for him, we started noticing then that very quickly, that when he was chanting his gayatri, he was thinking about the deer rather than the mantra. He again needed to go to his guru and ask for help. So he went down this contemplation, attachment, anger, etc. And you know, he learned his lesson, and he learned it, whether he learned it immediately or he learned it in time, he still learned it. So in the deer body, he was very detached, and then in the next human body, he was extremely detached. Then you have Ajamila. So Ajamila, the acharyas say that as soon as he said Narayana, he did think about the Narayana of his childhood. After all, he was in a situation of great emergency. And he had been accumulating Agyata Sukriti by saying, Narayana, please take your meal, Narayana, please sit here, Narayana, please. We've developed this habit in ISKCON now, I don't know why, especially with the women, of not using their name. It's become quite a habit that we just call each other just Mataji or just the woman, don't have a name. And Prabhupada said, if you remember even your own name at the time of death, you go back to home, back to Godhead. So here we have this advantage that we're surrounded by people with spiritual names, and sometimes we don't use them. It's actually quite unfortunate. So he was saying, just in the normal course of events, you know, Narayana, come here, Narayana, come here, Narayana, sit down, eat your meal, what are you doing running away? So he was accumulating all this Agyata Sukriti, and then he had all this accumulation from childhood. And so he was able, when he said Narayana just one time, that although he started by saying his son, he remembered Narayana. Now, of course, that didn't bring him to pure bhakti. What it did was it eradicated all of his karma. It liberated him. It put him in a position where he had clear vision. And then he was got that sadhu sangha of the Vishnu Buddhas and the Yama Buddhas arguing, and from that he made the determination, okay, I'm going to devote myself. So it wasn't something whimsical on Krishna's part like that. You know, you could say, okay, Krishna inspired him to name his son Narayana, but that inspiration was given because of his previous service. I mean, sometimes, I was just hearing this morning, Prabhupada saying that this Agyata Sukriti, it gives us the opportunity. So Ajamila got an opportunity. I mean, it was a very amazing opportunity to see the Vishnu Duttas and hear them discussing philosophy with the Yama Duttas. But it was still an opportunity to which he could respond in any way that he wanted. Does that make sense? And there's always going to be choosing to be Krishna conscious is constant. It's a minute by minute by minute by minute thing. Now when you're in love with Krishna, it doesn't feel like you're making a choice all the time. It's like, you know, you're taking care of your child. You're not feeling every second, I'm making a choice to take care of my child or kill my child or man, but you are. Yes? So it's a constant choice point. Do I choose to surrender to Krishna? We always have that kind of free will. And sometimes that opportunity can be given by the mercy of others. That can happen sometimes. So there's a very interesting story. There's a book called My Descent into Death. I forget the name of the author. Anyway, it was this very militant atheist. Really, really, really militant atheist. And he was an art professor in a college. One year, there was a nun who lived in a convent who came to take some of his classes because she was doing paintings, religious paintings in the convent. She wanted to get some additional lessons. And he said, no religious paintings in my class. I don't allow anything religious in my class. So she went back to the convent and told the other nuns, you know, I really got a doozy of a professor. You know, I can learn art from him, but I can't do any religious paintings in his class. So all the sisters said, why don't we pray for him? So they added his name to their daily prayers. Okay? So fast forward 13 years. And meanwhile, all these nuns are praying for him every single day. So 13 years later, he was in France. He was American. He was in France for some kind of convention or seminar or something. And he suddenly got very ill. he was brought to a French hospital, and somehow in the room, he died, and nobody was around. There were no doctors, nobody revived him anymore. And when he died, he left his body, and he thought he saw doctors and nurses. He didn't realize he was dead immediately. And they were saying, come down this hallway for some treatment, come down this hallway. So he follows them, and as he follows them, they start laughing at him and mocking him, and gradually they start revealing that they have forms of demons. And they start tearing apart his subtle body, and he was saying, of course you're a subtle body, but sexually molesting him and all these things in his subtle body. And all of a sudden he heard a voice that said, pray. And in his subtle body, he thought, well, I don't know how to pray. I've never prayed in my life. And I don't even think there's a God. But, okay, he was really terrified and suffering. But he didn't know any prayers. So he just said, God bless America! And the demons started backing off. And they said, don't do that. There's no God. Don't call out to anybody like that. Don't talk like that. But they backed off. And he thought, oh, maybe there's something to this. And he thought, okay, well, what do I know that has something religious in it? And he started thinking about like some nursery rhyme or some song from his childhood, anything that had God in it. And he just started saying it more, and finally they just backed off. And they left. And then some higher entity came, and he ended up having all these far experiences, and he got put back in his body, and he became a minister and a preacher and so forth and so on. And one time he was traveling, and he was at a church, and he was giving a lecture. So at the end of the lecture, you can understand him. So this nun comes up to him, and she said, I'm surprised it took so long. And he said, what are you talking about? And she said, for those 13 years, we were all praying for you every day. So sometimes that can come from an outside source. But what did they give him? They gave him an opportunity that he wouldn't have had otherwise. And they gave him an opportunity that he just hears this one word, pray. He didn't get a big opportunity. You follow? It wasn't a big opportunity. It was a little opportunity. And he took it. And I'm sure other people in that, wouldn't take it. But he took it. I have a similar story of one man who was a criminal. His wife died, and his mother rather died when he was very young. And his father was very religious. His father was always praying for him, praying for him, praying for him. The guy was completely criminal. And he was in prison over and over again. His father had died, and then one time in prison, he was in solitary confinement, and again, he just had a thought come to him. If you used all your energy for good, what great things could you do for the world? And it transformed him. And he later attributed the fact that he had that thought to the fact that his father had prayed for him for like 20 years. So it gave him some opportunity. That can be, which is why we try to go and give an opportunity to everyone. That's the purpose of our preaching. That's the purpose of our Harinam, our book distribution, our prasadam distribution. That by doing that, we give people some yati sukriti, and we give them some opportunity. And that if we have some will, if we just have some desire, that let everyone in the world become Krishna conscious, Krishna responds to that desire, and he gives people an opportunity. Even people who wouldn't normally have looked for that. So in that way you can say that things are not just equal. In that way you can say that if the devotees take upon themselves to give people an opportunity, then Krishna will give an opportunity to those, a special opportunity to those people. And therefore we're enjoined to do that, and therefore Krishna says anyone who does that is the most dear to me. And you can say, well, why doesn't Krishna just do that? Because Krishna is Yetamantapadete. Krishna is responding to the living entity. And Krishna is neutral. Krishna is not interfering with the free will of the living entity. As a super soul, he's just neutral. Otherwise, he'd be biased and he'd be whimsical and then you could criticize him. So, of course, you could criticize him anyway. But anyway, he just stays as neutral. At the same time, he has a desire to give all the living entities an opportunity. That's his desire. At the same time, he respects their free will. So, but okay, if the devotees, like Krishna says to the devotees in the Bhagavad Gita, they don't disturb the materialistic Krishna. Just set an example, don't disturb them. Because he doesn't want to ask them to take trouble. Huh? Right? Like sometimes you're at someone's house and you really want that beloved woman, and they say, would you like it? No, no. You don't want them to take it. Because Krishna doesn't want the devotees to take trouble. It's trouble to give opportunity to people who don't want it. Don't disturb. But the devotees know that Krishna wants to give an opportunity to everybody. So the devotee takes the trouble. And when the devotee takes that trouble, Krishna says there's no servant in the world more dear to me than he, nor there will be one more dear. So if someone voluntarily says, I'm going to take the trouble to give the opportunity to everybody, even those who are not asking for it, to keep giving them a chance, giving them a chance. And then Krishna says, oh, you want to give them a chance? Okay, I'll give them a chance. I'll give them a chance. You could say there's a general chance for all human beings because every human society has some system of religion. And every single human being knows something about religion, yes? So you could say in that sense that God is giving some kind of chance to anyone in the human form, and all living entities get a chance to be human beings. So we put it like that also. Is that all right? Did you have some questions?
Yeah, I mean, just since you touched on the topic of intent to blame God, I can identify with that. And I just often think, it's just, wouldn't it be like that the material world has to be necessarily so difficult to get out of? Like it's like a giant cobweb and a labyrinth mixed into one. It's like whichever way you step, you get stuck. And it just seems so impossible. Because we don't have a recollection of our last lives, mm-hmm. it's much harder to have faith in something that we haven't experience.
But those circumstances are all because that's what we want. So the reason we don't remember our past lives is because if we did, we wouldn't be able to fulfill our desires in this life.
But does the material world has to be created that difficult, that
powerful? It's not that difficult. On the higher planets, it's not that difficult.
Yes.
But we, this is where what we've desired and what we've earned. And the material wasn't it? If we first take birth as Lord Brahma, so as in our birth as Lord Brahma, to go back to Godhead from that birth is extremely easy. You're almost a pure devotee in that birth. You see the Lord is there, you have interchange with the Lord as your father, you're doing the service of the Lord, you're in almost pure goodness. Well, that's very easy. And even, you know, if we fall down from there to some of the higher planets, so there are the entities there, they have bodies that are in Satvaguna, which means they can see everything clearly. We have Bhagavatamrita, the Lord is there on their planets. It's extremely easy. It's just like, again, if you want to talk about, you know, alcohol. So if you're not drinking alcohol, it's easy to be sober. It's natural. And then, you know, you take one drink, you're not so entangled. Like, you take birth as Lord Brahma, you're not so entangled. You can put it down. But if you drink and drink and drink till you become an alcoholic, then you're very entangled. Then it's very difficult to get out. It's not. But that's not the fault. It's not even the fault of alcohol. Alcohol is just fermenting stuff that you could put in a compost pile and nourish your ground with. You can't even say, well, it's Krishna's fault that when things ferment, that they emit some poison that makes somebody intoxicated. You're not supposed to drink it. Does that make sense? So we've become very intent. We've entered deep within the banyan tree. Oh, I don't know if I can remember all the details of this story. It was about a woman who was... She was a professional in terms of like marathon walking and mountain climbing. She was a professional, she was trained. And she was visiting some relatives in Hawaii, and she decided that she was going to take a walk through the forest. And in writing the story, she says that even though she was a professional and she knew better, somehow she had some pride that, well, I know what I'm doing. I don't have to take all the precautions. So she didn't tell anybody exactly where she was going. She just said, I'm going for a walk. And then as she was going for a walk, she went off the main trail, and she went off the main trail without leaving markers, because she thought, oh, this is a very easy trail. You know, I'm a professional, I do very difficult, it's a very easy trail. so I can leave any markers. And then she got lost. So when she got lost, she saw a hill. And she thought, if I climb at the top of the hill, I'll be able to get a big view and I'll be able to see where I'm going. So as a professional, she had a pack with her with water and compass and flares and food and everything like that. So as she started to climb the hill, she saw that the hill was very steep and that she wouldn't be able to climb the hill with her pack. So even though she was a professional, she took off her pack and left it at the bottom of the hill. So she's climbing this very, very steep hill and she gets to the top and then she can see where to go, but she realizes that she can't get back down. That the way she came up, she can't go down, and the other side of the hill is even steeper, and she's completely stuck, and she's now stuck on a ledge that's only, you know, maybe a meter wide. Without food, without water, you know, without flare or anything. And so she has to spend the night there, and she realizes if she falls asleep, she can easily roll off the edge, so she has to stay awake all night. And then Hawaii is a pleasant climate, but still, it can get warm in the middle of the day, especially on a little hill. She's getting very thirsty. And at one point on the top of the hill, she says, God, why did you do this to me? And then she writes about how she had this, you know, mirror. You did this to yourself. Obviously, she got rescued, or we wouldn't know the story. But this is what we do. This is exactly what we do. And then we say, why is it so difficult for me to get out of here? Why am I so stuck? Why am I so entangled? Why am I so in my karma? Why did you make it so difficult, God? Why did you make the material world so entangled? But it's all, he's responding to our desires. Or, you know, if somebody pays to watch a movie and the movie's very engrossing and why is this movie so engrossing? But that's what you wanted. That's what you paid for. You know, we want an illusion. We want forgetfulness of God. We want to think that we're the controller. And it's our desire that attracts a strong covering over. It's completely Krishna reciprocating our desire, 100%. It's completely, and it's not really so difficult. How do you get out of a spider web? You have a strong knife. You know, if you try to like pull apart the web, or if you have a banyan tree and you try to, you know, you try to figure out where's the root, and then, you know, then it is. It's impossible. Or sometimes you have the, you know, roll of tape that's all, you have to use a knife. So once you use a knife, there's a story of Alexander the Great that he heard that there was this Gordian knot. You've heard this story? And anyone who could untie the knot could conquer the world. So as he had world-conquering aspirations, he went to see this Gordian knot. You know, he tries to untie it, and of course he can't. He takes out a sword and just cuts. So yeah, if you try to untangle it, what was I in my last life? What was this? How do I have this psychological problem? I mean, that may be useful in some temporary way to know that kind of stuff. You know, there's some value to psychology, etc. But if you really want to get out of the thing, you just have to cut it. You just have to cut this, I want to be the center, I want to be the controller, I want to be the enjoyer, I want to be the master of my destiny. Is that okay? Yeah. I think we should end here. Thank you very much. We hope that you do. This is a really shedding garment.